Michael, I have great affection for you, and you lead a very rich and interesting life, but you're a bagman, not an attorney. I have no criminal record in the state of New York, and the single determining criterion for involuntary incarceration is danger. Is the defendant a danger to himself or others? You think you got the horses for that? Well, good luck and God bless. But I tell you this, the last place you want to see me is in court.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show. I am Charlie. I'm in the studio with Amit, Fred, Wendy, Abby, a guest to be named later, and the young Master Doshi. This is where you say something, like hi.
Hi.
There you go. Each week on Lost in the Stacks, we pick a theme and then use it to create a mix of music and library talk. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
That's right, Charlie. Our show today is called The Case Act.
CASE stands for Copyright Alternative in Small Claims Enforcement Act of 2019.
Sounds boring.
Whoa. Fred. Okay, they do have a point, Amit. Maybe we should talk more about like the cultural conditions of late capitalism.
Well, it is not boring. In fact, this legislation could completely change how creators are able to protect their IP.
IP. Infinite pests.
That's true.
Illustrious pandemonium.
I like that. Intractable one. Parakeets?
What?
Ice cream, pancakes, tra-la-la.
What? That's trademarked. Okay. We're doing our best, but it's clearly not up to spec. So we need a lawyer to punch up the episode and to school us on where all of this is headed.
And to call our attorney for advice.
If you want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is LITS441 for Lost in the Stacks, episode 441. Feel free to tweet your thoughts, questions, or your favorite story about how you started out with the best intentions by doing a Creative Commons search, and then eventually, well, you know, with that hashtag.
Our songs today are about stealing, about big and small ideas, and about unintended consequences. The implications of the CASE Act may be hard to foresee, but we'll have to figure it out if the law passes. It'll be right there in the U.S. Code in black and white. So let's start with the DBs, black and white, right here on Lost in the Stacks. Thanks, Fred.
Black and White by the DBs from their legendary debut album. This is Lost in the Stacks, and our guest today is friend of the show and our legal advisor, Philip Burris of the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Fred, welcome. It's not the back credits yet, man. Don't mention them.
It's kind of redundant, isn't it? We're going to be saying that name a lot. So, Philip, thanks for coming on again.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the show. I'm a big fan of the show. I'm always happy to be here, but I can't. You guys are great friends, and I can't thank you enough for having me on the show again.
This is like number four, I think.
I think this is four.
We were trying to count up another one to get you to five, but I just can't. I think it's four.
I think it's four. Slaps, mailbag, one IP one early on, and then this one.
All right.
Well, being a lawyer, and particularly being an intellectual property lawyer, we've got an intellectual property law show lined up today. So
that's beautiful.
we're going to talk about the CASE Act. So first question, tell us, what is the CASE Act?
Well, Wendy covered it. You can't pass a bill these days without an acronym. And they really struggled for this acronym, right? Because it's Copyright Alternative in Small Claims Enforcement. And some of those letters don't quite make it into the acronym. But in short, it's a bill that was actually introduced by Doug Collins, along with Hakeem Johnson. Doug Collins is a Republican from Georgia. Hakeem Johnson is a Democrat from New York, in the House this May, to basically set up what they are calling a small claims court for copyright infringement. There's an identical bill in the Senate that was introduced by John Kennedy, who's a Democrat from Louisiana. And it's got some bipartisan support. There's 119 co-sponsors in the House. And 8 of 14 Georgia congressmen are on board. In the Senate, there are 14 co-sponsors. None of the Georgia senators are yet on board. But effectively, what it's going to do is create a copyright small claims court in the copyright office, where in theory, creators of works that have small claims can go and sue for infringement.
Do you feel like this is going to affect your daily business at all?
Not so much mine, because I don't litigate a lot of copyright matters. Copyright, to me, is the most fun part of intellectual property, because you get to talk about what is art. You get to talk about, you know, what is art? How do I infringe this, that, and the other? Copyright cases, because of cost, which is one of the things that's motivating these people to submit this bill, copyright litigation comes few and far between. It's big, big cases. It's expensive. If you want to sue for copyright infringement now in district court, for example, in the Northern District of Georgia, and you're suing a well-funded defendant, minimum, you're going to spend $300,000 just to kind of get in the door. And so the cost is so high. If I would love to be a copyright infringement lawyer, but people with that kind of money, there's just not so many of them. There's a lot of people that want to file patent applications, so I tend to do a lot of that. So it won't affect, to answer your question, it won't affect my business day to day, but I think it will affect the number of claims of copyright infringement that get filed in this country against defendants.
And the sense I have from the CASE Act, from the sort of reporting that surrounds it, is that it invents another department, a court inside the Copyright Office that is in some way managed by the Librarian of Congress, and that some people feel like it's a unaccountable entity.
That's true. And so this is not the first time that an administrative court to handle these types of procedures has been created. The Patent Office has one. They have the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which used to be the Patent Board of Appeals and Interferences that basically just heard appeals from examiners and the occasional interference. With the America Invents Act, they turned that into a court, the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. The Trademark Office has one too. So you're exactly right. This will be an administrative court under the executive branch of government that hears these judicial matters. And the reason I mention that is people have challenged the Patent Trial and Appeal Board as not being an Article III court. Article III is the article of the Constitution that sets up the Supreme Court and any lower courts under the Supreme Court that Congress may set up. And this is a court that's outside of that Article III. It's in the executive branch. It's an Article II court with administrative judges. Now, it kind of makes some sense that it's in the Library of Congress because they issue copyrights, but that has also been a criticism that if the Copyright Office sets up this administrative court, they may be pro-copyright holder because their business is giving people copyrights.
Okay, so I have two questions. First, is all of this going to be on the quiz? And second, do you have a personal opinion, and do you feel comfortable delivering that? And then follow-up question, who is this good for?
So I have an opinion. I can tell you who this is good for. Your first question was,
is it going to be on the quiz?
Is it going to be on the quiz? No quiz. And I've got lots of things, and I can tell you about how this is going to be set up and how it's going to be made up. I do have an opinion. The best laid plans sometimes of mice and men often go awry.
Who are the mice and who are the men? No. Okay.
So there are very noble people with noble intentions who want to set up this court. There's a great case where the Beastie Boys sued Monster Energy. They had a fellow named Z-Trip who created a mix. They ended up winning. They won $1.7 million, spent $2.4 million in attorney's fees to get there. There are very noble intentions behind this bill. We can talk about it later, but the way it's been crafted, I'm not sure it's going to turn out to be a small claims court the way magistrates court is in Georgia. And third question.
Well, no, I have a new question.
Oh.
So this is supposed to solve a problem.
In theory, yes.
And that problem is that people have to spend too much money to sort of enforce their copyrights, or what's the problem that they think they're solving?
So you have to sue. You have to sue now in federal court. Federal court's very different from state court. There's a lot of formalities and a lot of procedures. You've basically got to have a lawyer. You don't represent yourself pro se unless you're a not too smart criminal in federal court. So you have to do that. And then typically if you have, you have to have lawyers to go to federal court. If you have a motivated defendant, they're going to spend a lot of money. So the complexity and the cost, I think, are the primary motivators driving this CASE Act to try and set up something that's easier for somebody who says, hey, this website ripped off my picture and I need to get justice. They really don't have a venue and are not being served by District Court of Georgia. So the motivation for this, I think, is noble.
And this is the standard, is the official definition of small claims like the cost or the individuals who are involved? Like, how does small claims get defined?
It's typically by the judgment that you can win, and okay. That's the case here as well. The maximum under the Case Act that you can win in a case is $30,000. But one of the criticisms is that's a lot more than in small claims court in the state, for example. In Georgia, I believe it's $15,000, maybe $18,000. I haven't checked. But I think it's around $15,000. But this is an order of magnitude above that. This is twice that. So,
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, if the maximum is $30,000, but the maximum for one infringement is $15,000. So
that's correct.
Okay.
So it's $15,000. So if you timely register, if you register your copyright before publication, the maximum in damages per infringement is $15,000 with a maximum per claim per case of $30,000. And that gets dropped down if you did not timely register your copyright to $7,500 per infringement, $15,000 per claim. But and talking on a per case basis, if you've got somebody with multiple infringements, it's $30,000 is kind of the limit, the max limit. And one of the criticisms is that's really not small. That's real money for a lot of people.
Okay. This has been quite a lot, so I think we need to just take a moment. I do want to get my notes copied down, because I bet you there's going to be a quiz. I know you said that there wouldn't be, but there's going to be one. We'll be back with more from Philip about the concerns about this act after a music set.
File this set under KNS1104.N37. You just heard Bad Ideas by Saint Seneca, and before that was Stealing Time from the Faulty Plan by Phish. Those were songs about ideas that may not be practical.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and our show today is called The Case Act. Our guest is Philip Burris of the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia. In the first segment, Philip, we pretty much figured out that this is an alternative claims court meant to help smaller copyright holders, you know, not corporations, not people with a ton of money, get relief or satisfaction.
That's correct.
And yet, there's a lot of people who feel like it's not going to do that, and it's actually going to create, as you said, unintended consequences.
That's correct. One of the criticisms of the act is it's not limited to small players, and it can be abused by corporations who want to bring small players into an alternate venue that might cost just as much as district court. It can be abused by what they're calling trolls who may or may not have a copyright registration, because you don't necessarily have to have a copyright registration to get into this court.
Okay, we talked about that off air, and this has to be said again and slowly.
I'm telling you, the way the bill is written right now in the House. So let's take a step back. If you want to sue somebody in district court, federal district court, you've got to have a copyright registration. Registration gives you standing in federal court, and they will bounce your case out of court if you don't have a federal registration. The way the Case Act is written right now, you do not have to have a federal registration. You have to have copyright in a work. But as you guys covered a few weeks ago, under the 1976 Copyright Act that went into effect in 1978, once you fix a work in a tangible medium, take a picture, sing a song into a tape recorder, write something down, save it in a computer, you get some rights. You get more rights if you file an application with the Copyright Office and you get a registration. And you get even more rights if you do that before you publish your work. Under the Case Act right now, you do not have to have a registration. You can file a claim. And the way the act is written, they will hold a case in abeyance for up to a year till you obtain your registration, which is one of the criticisms of the act, the way it's written. And keep in mind the way legislation is made. It's not congressmen sitting down and typing these things up. Legislative aides who work with industry groups and stakeholders put together this legislation. It goes into Congress. And one of the great things about our system is people do speak up, and they do speak up on either side. And so the bill, as it stands now, may or may not be how the bill is passed, if it ever passes, because this is the second iteration of a small claims court. Another one was introduced, two were introduced in 1996. Neither of them got out of committee. These two have been referred to the floor from the committee. So,
I've got a kind of a devil's advocate question here. So in a hypothetical situation, like someone that has a picture that they've taken that's not registered in copyright, but they've put it online or something. They haven't gone to the copyright office and registered it.
Right.
Obviously, they have the copyright.
Right.
And, I don't know, a T-shirt company uses that picture and, you know, puts it out in online advertisements on Facebook or something. It seems like this
Fred,
would be a
nothing
good,
like that has ever happened.
It seems like this would be a good venue for someone that, you know, is finding their creative work used in a way they didn't want, and then and they don't have $300,000 to go to federal court. This might be a good venue for that. If not, why not, and what should we do to help that person?
So I think that is the intent of the bill. The sponsors of this bill are trying to solve the exact situation that you described, because those folks are just not being served by the legal system right now. When I was in the sixth grade, there was this little kid, and we'd say the Pledge of Allegiance, and when it ended with liberty and justice for all, he'd say, "Who can afford it?" And it was funny. He was an insightful, cynical kid, but it was always funny. But I have quoted that so many times because, honestly, of the legal claims and the folks that need legal assistance out there, I would venture a guess that the court system is serving maybe 20% of them. So the noble cause for setting up this bill is to serve exactly that person. If it worked the way Magistrates Court in Georgia does, and Magistrates Court is the small claims court in Georgia, it would be a good venue. I have a feeling if the Patent and Trademark Office, the way they've set up their courts, are any inclination, you're still going to have a lawyer, and there's still going to be a big price tag associated with this venue, so it may not serve that client. The flip side argument is, if somebody comes with that picture on a T-shirt and sues you, this is a voluntary court. You don't have to go to this court, but you only have 60 days to opt out. If you don't opt out, you waive your right to go to district court, and you waive your right to any jury trial. The other thing is, if you don't opt out and you don't show up, you can get tagged with a default judgment. And that default judgment, even if they didn't timely register their copyright, could be a statutory damage of $7,500 for that infringement. So some of the critics, and I sound like I'm a critic, I'm really not. I'm just voicing the opinions of both of them, because I do think this is a noble cause. I do worry sometimes, how do I say this? I do worry sometimes how the government implements noble causes, because there are some unintended consequences. But it's a noble cause. But one of the criticisms is trolls who have a picture, and you created a website, and maybe you just didn't know. Maybe you're a school teacher and you're not versed in copyright law, because it's complex. And you were told by somebody in the school that you could clip that site and put it on the website, that somebody will come along and file this thing. You don't opt out. And all of a sudden, you're tagged with $7,500 charge for building your fourth grade website with a picture that's not yours. That's the flip side of the criticism. One of the reasons magistrate court works so well is the judges there kind of expect pro se, that's people who represent themselves, plaintiffs and defendants. So a lot of the rules of civil procedure, they kind of waive. They won't admit this, but they relax them a lot. So you don't have to authenticate evidence and go through all these different things. They work with the plaintiff and defendant to get to a just resolution. My experience based on the Patent and Trademark Office is these federal agencies don't waive anything. So you can't get there and say, well, I just came with my documents and here's what I've got. They're going to say, we can't work with that. I've got a suspicion you're going to really need a lawyer to navigate this court if the bill were implemented as it is today. It may change, and it may limit who can come. It may limit damages and things like that. But I think based just on Patent and Trademark Office, it's going to be expensive. Maybe not as expensive as federal court, but could be. And it's still going to require you have a lawyer that you pay a lot of money to.
So I feel like this is going to bounce us into the next segment, but for libraries who tend to be maybe slightly risk averse, yes. Should we be worried about a culture of more casual copyright suits?
You all are so sophisticated in the world of copyright. As the show a few weeks ago with the Zeppelin Spirit case showed, you're savvy enough to navigate this. And if you get a claim, you will understand how to handle it. And you also are so sensitive to copyright issues, both on the fair use and the protection side. There are all these policies in place. You're good. I wouldn't be worried about the Georgia Tech Library at all. You worry about small folks who never intended to infringe. They didn't intend at all. they don't understand with all the spam and other stuff they get in the mail that this is a real complaint they have to respond to and they have to opt out, and they don't know that. Those are the folks that would really need to worry, I think.
We'll be back with more about the CASE Act of 2019 on the left side of the hour.
Hey, this is David Lowry from Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven, and you are listening to Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta. Cool.
Today's Lost in the Stacks is called the CASE Act. I'd like to read from a landmark ruling in 1976 by Judge Richard Owen of the Southern District of New York. What happened? I conclude that the composer, in seeking musical materials to clothe his thoughts, was working with various possibilities. As he tried this possibility and that, there came to the surface of his mind a particular combination that pleased him as being one he felt would be appealing to a prospective listener. In other words, that this combination of sounds would work. Why? Because his subconscious knew it already had worked in a song his conscious mind did not remember. Having arrived at this pleasing combination of sounds, the recording was made, the lead sheet prepared for copyright, and the song became an enormous success. Did Harrison deliberately use the music of He's So Fine? I do not believe he did so deliberately. Nevertheless, it is clear that My Sweet Lord is the very same song as He's So Fine, with different words, and Harrison had access to He's So Fine. This is, under the law, infringement of copyright, and is no less so, even though subconsciously accomplished. I love that a Southern District judge defended a Beatle, even as he laid down the law. File this set under KU1100.F58.
You just heard What We Have We Steal by the Toadies, and before that was Smiley We Become by Sissy Barr, and those were songs about taking what was created by others.
Our show today is called The CASE Act. Our guest is Philip Burris of the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia. So we've gotten into the weeds of the CASE Act, a lot of very interesting weeds, I got to say, and relevant details. But if you go to the website GovTrack and look at the likelihood of this pass, they've got it at a 4% likelihood that this is going to become law. So are we just talking about something that's just going to be a moot point anyway? Are we going to go back to copyright status quo?
It depends on who you talk to. So this is the second iteration, like I said, of this bill. In 1996, there were two other iterations of this bill. It's got some good support, especially in the House. It's got, like I said, 119 co-sponsors. Not so much in the Senate, the identical bill in the Senate. We've got a Congress now that's got a lot of stuff going on, especially in the House of Representatives. You might have heard this little impeachment inquiry. It's very polarized. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a patent reform bill that's pending right now to change what's eligible to be patented due to some recent case law. I know an attorney here that went and testified at the hearings in the committee there. They were so excited. They said, this has so much bipartisan support, is going to pass this year. I don't know how much of anything is going to get out of Congress this year. So their 4% might be driven by all of the other stuff that's going on in Congress, and maybe just the state of Congress today. Like I say, it's very noble what they're trying to do. I think this bill could be refined to make it better. And that process, getting people on the left and right sides of the aisle today, is very challenging.
I want to go back to something you said earlier and expand on it a little bit. You said these representatives are not literally writing bills, right? They are thinking that this is a good idea. They are agreeing it's a good idea, but then the language is often written by aides,
right,
who
That's
have
right.
connections to industry.
That's right.
Right. I don't see the folks who this case is, the CASE Act is supposed to help. I don't see them being the ones who are talking to the people who are writing the bill. It seems like it is industry, right, the folks who stand to make a lot of money or protect money-making assets. We mentioned Disney earlier, and we don't need to go any farther down that road. Do you feel like this is well-intentioned but misguided or misadvised?
So my limited experience, I interned a little while with Sam Nunn when he was a senator here, is you're correct. So the legislation gets written by a legislative aide who talks to a lot of stakeholders. Industry does have a lot of say because they have a lot of money, and they can give money to candidates. The two things that, this is my opinion, the two things that political candidates listen to are one's money and the other's votes. If you come in with a block of votes, you will also get the ear. They talk not only to industry, who does get a seat at the table due to their financial resources, but they will also talk to groups. And there are authors' guilds, there are publishing guilds, there are groups that represent these small copyright holders. And I say small, they're copyright holders who may have very fantastic works. They just don't have the financial resources of a very large company. And so there are several organizations who also get a seat at the table, because if the organization is big enough, they bring in a lot of votes. And if they have a lot of authors, for example, or songwriters or any kind of creator who really wants this alternate venue, who's not being served by district court, and they have a collective voice that's organized, they get a seat at the table too. And my experience is, like I say, this is a noble cause. And I think in general, the legislators want to pass things that benefit society and want to pass things in a correct way. So they take their best shot at it, and it gets refined in Congress. And hopefully you get a good bill at the end.
Why is 2024 an important date?
Oh, 2024 is when Steamboat Willie falls in the public domain. So you remember the last time that happened, there was the Sonny Bono Act that extended the copyright term. And under the Constitution, the term's supposed to be for limited times. And it's very long now. And there were court cases on that. This is not a limited term. But it will be interesting to see if between now and the beginning of 2024, if the copyright term gets extended, because it's not black letter, but the rumor is that Disney had a lot of input into that extension because of Mickey Mouse. You've had other guests on the show who are more educated in the history of the statute than I am, who cited three or four other reasons that the copyright term got extended. But if you're some kind of conspiracy theorist and you think the mouse runs the world, then you can look at 2024 to see if the copyright term gets extended.
I take serious issue with calling it a conspiracy, Philip. It's just a question of correlation and causation.
There you go.
So we talked a little bit about libraries and how maybe the Georgia Tech Library doesn't need to be too worried at this point. I mean, and the whole 4% likelihood of passing estimate. But are there things that maybe as folks in libraries who are interacting with patrons, with end users who want to reuse our content, like are there ways that we can help sort of educate folks about what kind of reuse is safe to sort of like, I don't know, prevent any inadvertent mistakes on the part of the reusers of our content or our students who are learning from us?
Absolutely. You can educate in two ways. You can educate your congressmen and your senators. Like I said, Doug Collins from Georgia is one of the original sponsors of the bill in Congress. To the extent that the Georgia Tech Library had input for the congressman, I'm sure they would be very receptive to it. To answer your question, absolutely. There are a lot of ways. We've talked about this many times. Copyright infringement and fair use can be a gray area. You don't really know if it's fair use until the judge tells you it is. You don't really know if you infringe until the judge tells you it is. That can all be very expensive. But there are safe harbors out there that you can educate all folks for. A license absolves a lot of things. Anytime there's a question, if you just get a license, a lot of times it's very cheap or people will just give it to you. The things that you know are in the public domain, those types of things are okay. And then also, like you've done with some of your shows, people who voluntarily put their works in the public domain, codified in a writing, hey, I am putting this in the public domain, you can use it. Those types of things you can help steer people to if they want to copy them. And if they want to use material but don't want to infringe copyright, you can educate them on how to do things that might be more like fair use. For example, criticisms, academic works, reviewing and looking at things. Those types of things, while I know you're not lawyers and you're not giving legal advice, you are well-versed in those types of issues, and you can be a helper who helps those people who are not being served by the legal system at the moment. or who don't have a lawyer. There's so many people who don't have a lawyer, can't afford one, don't want one. You can be a helper. Because in this CASE Act, you don't necessarily have to have a lawyer represent you. You can have a law student who represents you on a pro se basis. So there are other ways to get copyright information, and I would recommend people avail themselves of those, including their libraries, because generally speaking, libraries are pretty well versed in this field.
It seems like such a... You were talking off air about federal versus local and how local courts can often sort of make accommodations for sort of the standards of the community, right, or sort of figure out like, oh, this is not going to happen, this kind of paperwork, so we're not going to worry about it. Whereas federal, it's like, nope, it has to be exactly this. Almost like the sheriff versus the FBI, you know, the local versus the outside authority. And I feel like this is a statement of we need to go more local and remember that peer-to-peer sort of licensing or discussions between individual creators and individual remixers is the better way to go.
So I won't speak for all federal judges, because I know there are a lot of federal judges who make accommodations for cases in their courts. They're just so much there's so many fewer federal judges. They have such huge dockets. The expectation is that you know the rules of civil procedure. The question with copyright is problematic, because under the 76 Copyright Act, effectively state copyright law was preempted by federal rule. So you can't go anymore really into state court at all and sue for copyright infringement. You have to go in federal court because it's a federal question. And under the 1909 Copyright Act, there still was state copyright law. But the 76 Copyright Act effectively preempted any state copyright law. So the model from the state court, small claim court, to the extent it can make it into this bill, I think would be a very good thing. It would still be a federal court or a federal agency in this case, which falls under the executive branch. But I think that model, and this is one of the criticisms, is they should limit the people who can come to this court. And some folks say that it shouldn't be a big corporation with 50 lawyers who shows up. It should be pro se representatives. And if you've got a lawyer, you go to court. And if you are pro se, you go to this. That's not in the bill as it is now. Would that be helpful? Possibly.
You're supposed to finish with, it depends.
It always depends. You never know. The first question, the first answer you learn in law school is, it depends.
Well, if it's on TV, I'm definitely watching. This is Lost in the Stacks, and we've been speaking with our friend, Philip Burris of the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group. Philip, thanks again for being back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I always enjoy it. You guys are so great. I love listening to the show. 440-some episodes now?
441, man.
441. That's crazy. Anyway, thank you so much.
File this set under S.1273 of the 116th Congress of the United States. You just heard Demons by Earthheart, and before that, One Mint Julep by The Clovers, and those were songs about being captivated by an idea and about small actions having big consequences.
Our show today is called The CASE Act, and I've got the quiz right here. Amit, you ready to take it?
Yes.
Okay.
Ready.
Question one, is the CASE Act good or bad?
It depends.
Will the CASE Act pass?
It depends.
Third question, do you have copyright protection for the work you've done?
It depends.
100%.
Yes!
Well done. Roll those credits.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library. Produced by Charlie Bennett, Amit Doshi, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Rasko.
Abby was our engineer today, and the show was brought to you in part by the Library Collective, which is currently taking session proposals for next year's conference. You can find out more at thelibrarycollective.org.
Legal counsel and officially licensed mouse ears were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Philip for being on the show, to everyone who contributes to the Creative Commons,
And thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
You can find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcast pretty much anywhere you get your audio fix.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, we talk with archivists about learning from the mistakes of the past and not repeating them.
It's time for our last song today. We may not know the ultimate fate of the CASE Act or what will be the consequences if it's enacted, but it's clear that until things get sorted out, there will be some angst and worry about the outcomes from either side of the issue. So let's close with Shot by Both Sides by Magazine right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Oh, that'll depend, Amit.
Yes, always depends.